Good afternoon. This meeting of the Senate Resources Committee will come to order at 3:30 p.m. in the Butcherovich Room, number 205. Today is Friday, February 28th. Members present today are Senator Giesel, Senator Coghill, and Senator Keel. Of course, myself, Senator Machicki. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Please silence your cell phones. On our agenda today, we have SB 159, Saltwater Fishing Operators Guides, and Senate Bill 189, Sport Fishing Enhancement Surcharge. First up, we have SB 159, Saltwater Fishing Operators Guides. To present the bill, we have Dave Rutz, Director, Division of Sport Fish, Tom Tobby, Deputy Director, Division of Sport Fish, and Brian Frenette, Assistant Director, Division of Sport Fish. Online, we also have Cheryl Booking, Department of Labor. So please join us, and when you're ready, please present the bill.
For the record, my name is Rachel Hankey. I'm the legislative liaison for the Department of Fish and Game, and Director Rutz is online, and he's going to go ahead and do the opening statements.
Thank you. Director?
Oh, I just got unmuted, so. Thank you, Chairman Machicki, and distinguished members of the Senate Resources Committee. For the record, my name is David Rutz, Director of the Division of Sport Fish. With you there today is Tom Tobby, the division's deputy director, Brian Frenette, assistant director, budget manager extraordinaire, and Rachel Hankey, whom all of you know. So if you can't hear me or understand me very well, please let me know. I'm still getting over the crud that was going around at the Upper Cook Inlet Board of Fish meeting. Senate Bill 159 will reinstate sport fishing guide and operator licensing standards and fees for saltwater guide and operators. The sport fish guide and operators licenses were first adopted during the 2003-2004 Alaska legislative session and took effect in 2005 and remained in effect through December 31, 2014, when they expired due to a sunset clause. During the 2015-2016 legislative session, the saltwater licenses were reinstated again, which sunsetted again in 2018. The department would like to see these licenses in statute in perpetuity. The license fees have been used to pay the cost of collecting logbook data, which is the reporting section of this bill. Logbook data has been collected by the department from saltwater sport fishing businesses and guides since 1998 and is critical to upholding the state's U.S.-Canadian Pacific Salmon Treaty obligations, as well as providing crucial data to the International Pacific Halibut Commission. It is also critical for the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council for managing federal fisheries, avoiding duplicative reporting mechanisms and undue burden on the charter fishing industry. Logbook data has many other additional uses, which you can see in the logbook use summary provided. In pretty much that summary, it lays out all the needs and obligations of what the logbook program provides. So if the committee would like, Ms. Hankey can walk you through the bill, and I'm available for questions. And if I can't answer them, my much more learned and accomplished colleagues, Big Tom Tobby and Brian Frenette, should be able to give you any answers that you need. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rutz. Ms. Hankey.
Thank you. For the record, Rachel Hankey, Legislative Liaison, Department of Fish and Game. The first section establishes the license fees for guides at $200 and operators and the combined license at $400. Section 2 adds a new article to AS 1640. 1640.262 is the operator's license. Requirements include business license and insurance. 1640.272 is the guide and the combined license. Requirements included being a citizen of the U.S., Canada, Mexico, or have resident alien status, certified in first aid, and a current sport fishing license. 1640.282 is the reporting provision, which is the logbook. This includes vessel information, effort, catch, harvest, and locations. 1640.292 is the penalty section of the bill. And 1640.301 is definitions for guide and guide services. Section 3 is a conforming change to add licenses to 2527244. And Section 4 is the effective date, January 1, 2021.
Thank you, Ms. Henke. Any questions so far? I have a question. Is this, what were the fees that expired back in 2018, I believe Mr. Rutz said?
Through the chair, I believe they're about right at half of what we're asking for. I think it was $200 for guide fee and then or the guide and operator fee, and then $100 for the guide fee. And Tom, you can chime in if you catch me being wrong.
Mr. Rutz, can you hold off for a minute, please?
Sure.
And please identify yourself for the record when you begin talking. But how about the combined fee? Has it always been the same as the saltwater fishing operator license?
Through the chair, my name is Tom Talby. Deputy Director, Division of Sport Fish. Yes, the combined fee has been the same as the operator license. So here it's $400, and previously it was $200. So if you were an operator and a guide, you paid the full amount as a business did.
Thank you, Mr. Talby. Can you explain why the I'm not seeing any other questions. I'll certainly let's go to Senator Coghill. You may ask something I was going to ask. Senator Coghill.
High-end question. We're reinstating, but I see it's amended, a new section. Is that following the same structure as the law was previously, or is this new section, new verbiage that is being considered?
For the record, Rachel Hinke, through the chair, Senator Coghill. It is mostly the same. The reporting requirement was left out of the last version, and previous to being left out of the last version, it was in the version before that.
So reinstating old language plus the reporting, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to make sure that I think we had gone through this once time before, but I just wanted to ask straight up if it's same language, because when we're putting new language in, we call it's a new section, but it's really not new language for us. I just wanted to make that very clear. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if we could just sort of go over the numbers a little bit. How many guides are we talking about in saltwater? How many guides do we have in the state total?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, Tom Talby, Deputy Director, Division of Sport Fish. It's approximately, for saltwater guides, about 1,200, 1,300 guides and businesses. If you include freshwater, because we still do freshwater registration, it's about double that. So there's about an equal number, so about 2,200 to 2,400 guide and guide businesses statewide for both fresh and saltwater.
Follow up? Thank you. So the two pager in here about how useful the logbooks are to the Board of Game, to the advisory committees, to fisheries managers, made some great points. I guess the question would be, why only do half of them? Why saltwater only?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, at this time, we've submitted saltwater because we have support from the saltwater guide industry. We had dropped freshwater logbooks at the beginning of 2019, partly due to funding, not having sufficient funding to continue that program, and lack of support from the freshwater guide industry to complete the logbooks. And that the concern from the freshwater guiding industry was that we were not using that information for management purposes. It's the data we collect from both fresh and salt water is usually post-season information, because the logbooks are turned in season. There's a two-week requirement, but by the time the data is compiled, it's post-season. We are converting to e-logbooks, electronic logbooks, and so for the 2021 season, we're mandating that all saltwater guides complete their logbook with the e-logbook. So that should expedite the data processing, where we could have that information much sooner. Right now for King Salmon, we have to have numbers available by mid-July to determine where we're at in regards to our treaty obligations for the Pacific Salmon Treaty. And that's about the same time frame for halibut, when we start generating our reports for halibut harvest for the North Pacific Fishery Management Council in the fall.
Senator Keel, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just it seems as though certainly not all of the benefits you listed were in-season management benefits. It seems like more data helps the board and the biologists do a better job. But sounds like with the implementation of e-logbooks, that information will be available in season for just about everybody then, right?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, it would be provided sooner. I guess in season is kind of a relative term. But we would be able to probably have access to some preliminary data within several weeks of the logbook information being completed, because there still has to be compiling of the information, which takes some time for data analysis to occur in season. But it would be much sooner than what we're receiving it now with the paper logbooks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Taube, why has this bill sunsetted twice in the last 8 years? I'm sorry, in the last 6 years.
Mr. Chair, when the legislation has been adopted, there was a sunset clause. I'm not really certain why the reason for each time there was a sunset clause, but my familiarity with the statutes have been, when initially was adopted in 2005, there was a five-year sunset, and then every year after that was a two-year sunset. But the rationale for that I'm not familiar with.
Okay, I guess the way I can ask that a different way. It's obviously a priority to the department at this time, or we wouldn't be sitting here. Why was it not the previous times that it sunsetted and expired?
Mr. Chair, I believe it was a priority for the department. We would have preferred to have the license fee put in place permanently, but as I said, I'm not certain why that sunset provision was put in there.
Yes, Senator Coghill.
In the fiscal note, one of the things that they said primarily was because of concerns over the freshwater guide licensing logbook. And I think I only remember some of that discussion, and that was a value question, right? Did they bring any value? I think you already said that. But I have another question, if I might.
Senator.
So as we go back down this road, you are – licensing individuals and labeling boats. Tell me how that works as far as recording.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, I'm assuming you're talking about the vessel registration.
Yeah.
When guide businesses come in and get licensed, they are required to get logbooks for their guides that work for them. At the same time, they register their vessels with the department, and so in the logbook there's a vessel registration form, and they record all the vessels that are being utilized by their business for that season. If they have changes, if a boat goes down during the season, they can contact us and add a replacement vessel on there, but that's how we track which vessels are being used for guiding. They also receive a large decal that's often referred to as the watermelon. It's a previous director's favorite football team's colors, that gold and green, and then every year they get a little annuals tab that goes on each side of that vessel once they register that vessel. So when they come register, if they've done it before, we just give them a renewal tag that they put on their vessel, and those registration is done free of charge.
Right. There's more about this industry that I don't understand than I do, so that was question number one. The next thing is, what are the accountability to the individuals when it comes to licensing with regard to the logbook? Are there accountability measures worked into this for misapplication of the logbooks, or is that, do they take vessel tags away, or is there something that goes to the person who's licensed?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, if citations can be issued if logbook information isn't completed as described in the logbook. Currently, logbook instructions require that logbooks are completed before fish or passengers are offloaded. And then they must be completed and turned into the department after 1 week, which we also allow a week grace period in there. So essentially 2 weeks within the time frame is when reports are due. We've been somewhat lenient on the reporting provisions. If someone is remote and they cannot get the logbook sheets into us, we've given folks waivers that they have a month's time, or they have turned their logbook sheets at the end of the season. But there have been individuals that have been cited for incorrectly completing logbooks or falsely completing logbooks or not turning logbooks in within the time frame required.
Mr. Chairman, if I might continue down that line, if we go to e-logging, then that would switch that up, it'd be my guess. And so then there are places where you could download faster, and then your accountability measures would be a little more cleaner. Am I understanding that correctly?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, yes, that's the e-logbooks essentially, they collect the same information the paper logbooks do. The way the e-logbooks work is that once a trip is complete, and the guide or business is within connectivity, they upload their logbook sheets. They have 2 days to still access those, to change those if there's some corrections they need to do. And then they are automatically uploaded to the department, and then the guide or guide business can no longer make changes to those logbook sheets. So within 2 days of a trip being completed, we have that information in our hands. So the citations or violations would be the same for failure to complete correctly with the e-logbook. It's just a more efficient means of collecting information. And there's efficiencies for the guides being able to, if they're taking the same client out multiple days, once they're entered in once, they can repeat those people in the future days to record those into the logbook. If they have the right IO system, or if they have a Android platform, they can scan the licenses, and that will upload the client information automatically. So the idea behind the e-logbooks was to make things much more efficient for the guides as well as the department getting that information.
And one last question from an unlearned guy. How many licensed operators can be on a tagged boat?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, generally it's one guide per boat. As long as there could be multiple guides on a single vessel, there's no requirement, but it's generally one logbook per vessel, so those guides would be recording in the same logbook. One would be considered the deckhand, and the lead guide would be recording that information from that trip. I can't think of many circumstances where you'd have two guides with two complements of clients on that vessel that would have a separate logbook for each.
So, Mr. Chairman, is that explicit in how this operates? I'm just thinking of the accountability. Is it an economic relationship or a legal relationship is what I'm trying to get at?
It would be a legal relationship.
Okay. Yeah. So one boat, one guide.
One logbook.
What are the requirements of the deckhand for licensing?
Deckhands are not required to be licensed. They fall under the guide's license. If they are operating on their own, so if a guide has it's on a float trip, and they're separate from each other, that would not be a deckhand. They would be providing sport fishing guide services. But within the definition of sport fishing guide services, a deckhand is excluded from licensing requirements.
Does a deckhand require a current sport fishing license?
Mr. Chair, yes, they do.
I have a couple follow-ups. One is, are the insurance and other requirements the same as they were in the past, such as first aid and a driver's license? Is that all the same as they've been in the past?
Mr. Chair, yes, it is.
Okay. So there's a section in section page 4, line 28. The person who is required to complete reports under this section may not provide false information or admit material facts in a report. A person in the state of Alaska that is under the age of 16 does not require a sport fishing license. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, it is. Actually, it's an Alaska residents under the age of 18 do not require a license. Non-residents under the age of 16 do not require a license.
So if I am a guide on a halibut fishing boat and there happens to be someone that looks like they're under 16 and their parents say that they are under 16 and that is found out later that the person was actually above the age of out-of-state person that happens to be 17. They suddenly find their ID when they're boarded. What protects the guide from that? And obviously, you know that I'm thinking about this for a very specific reason. What protects the guide from not being guilty of filing a false report?
Mr. Chair, that would be dependent upon what the enforcement officer determines from the investigation. If the guide had made every intent to find out the information, and in the case I'm aware of is that initially the person was charged, but then those charges were dropped because it was determined that the guide had asked, and the parents had told them that, and we're not requiring guides to basically ask for birth certificates and that to verify that. It's the client would be responsible in that case.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a very uncomfortable winter in that particular case. So I may be wanting to talk to you about clarifying that just to ensure that that doesn't occur again. Any other questions? Okay, we have Mr. Frenette as wanting to testify. Okay. I had a yes, and then we have Cheryl Booking from the Department of Law, Fish and Game, online for questions. Do we have any additional questions? Is there anything you'd like to say as a closeout on this bill today?
Mr. Chair, we just look for your support for this bill, and as I mentioned earlier, we'd like to see this be put in place without a sunset clause if possible.
Thank you. I'm a little concerned that I think it's a little unfair to operators that have a lot of other things they have to worry about and a lot of requirements to meet for this roller coaster game on whether or not there's a guidebook program here in the last few years. So I agree that it's been somewhat mismanaged and unfair, and I understand about the saltwater guidebook being a part of this. But we are going to set this bill aside. Oh, wait a minute. I'm actually going to open public testimony because I'm actually surprised that we don't have anyone testifying. Is there anyone in the room or online that would like to testify on Senate Bill 159? Seeing none, we will keep public testimony open, and folks can send any written testimony on the bills we're going to hear today to SRES@akleg.gov. With that, thank you very much. We're going to hold this bill and bring it up next week. But I appreciate you bringing it forward to us today.
Chair.
Thank you. Next on our agenda, we have Senate Bill 189, Sports Fishing Enhancement Surcharge. We have the same team, so don't go away. And feel free to begin presenting that bill as well.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, once again, for the record, my name is Dave Rutz, Director of the Division of Sport Fish. Thank you for the opportunity and taking time to hear this Senate Bill 189, and I certainly hope you can hear me better than I can hear you guys. In 2005, the legislature approved a bond measure to construct two sport fish hatcheries, the William Jack Hatchery in Anchorage and the Ruth Barnett in Fairbanks. And I'm not sure, but some of you senators may have played a big role in this. In order to receive the bond, the Department of Fish and Game crafted a repayment plan that was somewhat unprecedented, to say the least. A surcharge of $9 was added to a sport fish license for residents and a bit higher for non-residents, all of which goes directly to the repayment of the bond. With the exception of $500,000 annually for hatchery production in Southeast Alaska. This plan had worked so doggone good that the department is paying this bond back 5 years early. Final payment, I believe, is scheduled for December of 2020. A promise was made at the inception of the bond that the surcharge would go away after the bond was paid. So the surcharge and all associated statutes are repealed at the end of this calendar year. In remembering that promise, while realizing what this funding source could do to maintain our enhancement operations, we are proposing a compromise, a reduction to what is currently being collected, $5 across the board. This leaves residents with a $4 surcharge and non-residents contributing the lion's share. This is approximately a 34% decrease. In your package, you will see the license fee breakdown. Additionally, the department proposes to collect that surcharge in a separate account within the Fish and Game funds to be accounted for and only used for the state sport fish enhancement programs and the sport fish hatcheries facilities. Upon repayment of the current bond debt, there is an immediate $500,000 funding loss that impacts Southeast Alaska from the loss of the surcharge income, which currently funds the raising and release of over 1.4 million Chinook salmon smolt at release sites targeted to benefit sport anglers in Southeast, mostly in inside waters, affecting mostly Alaskan residents. Losing this level of funding to support existing enhancement activities will be to the detriment of Southeast Alaska sport anglers. As you can see from the fact sheet in your packets, the sport fish enhancement programs release nearly 7.2 million fish annually into nearly 270 locations, most of which are lakes, and an additional 1.4 million in Southeast for Chinook production. These enhancement efforts generate hundreds of thousands of sport fish angler days, which in turn contribute significantly to local economies. In addition, fishing effort focused on enhanced Chinook in Southeast and South Central Alaska reduces effort on wild Chinook salmon stocks that are currently in the state of recovery. When the Ruth Barnett and Jack William hatcheries came online, nearly 5 million of Dingle Johnson funds had to be redirected in order to pay for their operations and maintenance. Any needed repairs and maintenance to date have come from existing operating budget funds, and it's usually done so at the expense of other division needs. There are also several larger, more expensive needs that were deferred during the construction and have yet to be assessed. As the facilities age, The maintenance needs will grow, thus permitting further undue burden onto existing programs. Having the ability to tap into source of funds to cover these needs will allow the division to sustain existing enhanced production without impacting elsewhere. There is, on average, $6.4 million generated in revenue from the surcharge collections on sport fish licenses. The division currently allocates a little of over $7 million to enhancement-related programs and projects across the division, with most tied to operations and maintenance at the two large sport fish facilities in both Anchorage and Fairbanks. Establishing this new reduced enhancement surcharge would cover existing costs allocated towards enhancement programs. It would also address deferred equipment and maintenance needs and ensure funds are available for unseen events at the facilities without having to go to the legislature for supplemental, or worst case, shut down the facilities. Okay, with that big mouthful, we'll be available for questions. If I can't answer them, my distinguished colleagues, Tom or Brian, should be able to come up with the answers. And you probably hear them a lot better than you can hear me. And after that, if the committee would like, Ms. Rachel Hanke is prepared to go over sectional analysis, and, well, quite frankly, I don't even know what that means.
Thank you, Mr. Retz. I appreciate that. Ms. Hanke, why don't we go ahead and go through the sectional?
For the record, Rachel Hanke, legislative liaison for the Department of Fish and Game. Section 1 of this bill references the enterprise account, which currently collects surcharge revenue for the bond repayment. This is amended to remove all the bond language and to create a new subaccount within the Fish and Game Fund called the Sport Fishing Enhancement Account. This section also allocates the revenue to sport fishing facilities to be used only for enhancement programs and facility maintenance. Section 2, this provision is the licensing section AS1605340. And sets the surcharge amounts for resident and non-resident sport fishing licenses. Amendments reference new surcharge uses and removes all bond language. Lastly, this section also imposes a $5 reduction, as mentioned. Section 3, this section being repealed removed a reference to 1605-340J, which we are now keeping in statute, so we are undoing the repeal. Section 4, this is another repealing section from Chapter 18, SLA 2016, which is amended to allow AS1605-130E and J to remain in statute beyond the sunset date. Section 5, this is similar to Section 3, so this makes amendments to retain a reference to that 340J. Section 6 is transition language that states any funds remaining in the enterprise account after the bonds are satisfied will be transferred over to this new created account. Section 7 and 9 together give Sections 1 and 2 an effective date of January 1, 2021. And Section 8, similar to Sections 3 and 5, retain a reference to the 340J.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Hanke? Mr. Taube, will you be fielding questions on this bill as well?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
So my first question is for Ms. Booking. Are we, is this bill clean enough to not compromise the dedicated fund issues? Is this DGF adequately accounted for?
I believe it is, yes. We have an established account right now for the bonds, and this would continue that to some extent.
Ms. Booking, could you do a little more research for me, please, and provide a more thorough answer for the committee?
I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Keel.
Here, while we're speaking with Ms. Brooklyn from Department of Law, just want to ensure that the proportion of funds and the relative fees from residents and non-residents don't raise any concerns with you. They strike me as appropriate, but I want to check in with the Department of Law on the appropriateness of that proportionality.
Yes, and I'm much more comfortable answering this question. This does not trigger the privileges and immunities clause that, if you're aware of the Carlson litigation that was impacted there. The privileges and immunities clause don't apply to sport fishing. It only would apply to commercial operations because the clause protects the ability of people to work in different states, and so it affects their ability to make a living. But these fees can be different for residents and non-residents, and the legislature has also done that with the license fees in 1605.340 for residents and non-residents and tag fees. So, yes, there's no legal problem with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Exactly what I was asking.
Thank you, Senator Keel. So, Mr. Taube, can you please define enhancement and maintenance for me so that we're clear on the expected activities for this funding if this bill were to leave this committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, Tom Taube, Deputy Director, Division of Sport Fish. Enhancement would be our fish production from our current hatcheries, sport fish hatcheries, which would be stocking products that we put into lakes or anadromous releases. Maintenance would be the maintenance of these facilities. At the time some of these, the two new hatcheries were built in Anchorage and Fairbanks, the costs had exceeded the original bids, and so certain components, like in Fairbanks, for example, a backup well was not included and produced. So we have, if our current well system fails, we probably end up with a bunch of dead fish in our Fairbanks hatchery. In the Anchorage facility, we've had issues with corrosion in some of the pipes, so there's replacement equipment and materials that need to happen there. We also need to upgrade our effluent system to stay with standards of the discharge that we put into Ship Creek, as well as providing some better access for the public when they're looking at our exterior raceways when we're doing our egg takes. So maintenance would include just general wear and tear on equipment on these facilities to keep them going into the future.
So just as a follow-up to that question, is there a reason why it doesn't say funding to sport fishing facilities maintenance associated with enhancement or something that tightens that up? Is there? It seems like there's a clear separation there.
Mr. Chair, I believe by including enhancement would allow the disbursement of the monies to Southeast Alaska that are currently being provided with the bond package. There's $500,000 that goes to King Salmon production in Southeast Alaska for sport anglers. And we would like to maintain that amount, at least that amount, to provide, since there was no hatchery produced, new hatchery produced in Southeast Alaska when the interior and South Central hatcheries produced, we still want to provide some enhancement opportunities in Southeast Alaska.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Coghill?
For us in the interior, we're okay with the King Salmon hatchery. But I remember a little bit of the background on this. There was some expectation when we made the promise that this surcharge would go away, that the hatchery in Fairbanks, for example, would be able to benefit from some warm water from a power unit, which didn't happen. And among other things, there were some other extraordinary costs, I think. So the expectation both for the operation and maintenance of it didn't really come in the way I think people expected. So, but for me, we have invited people in the interior often just based on our ability to bring fish to the interior without having to truck them all the way up the highway. so we're grateful for it. But it is kind of the problem that we enter into often, and that is when we put a surcharge on something with the expectation it's going to go away, some of these unforeseen problems just kind of find themselves into this. And then when we go back to our constituents and they say, we heard the surcharge was going away, and it doesn't, we struggle with those things. So we have to be able to make our justification. And so I thought I'd bring some of my memory to the table on it. I think some of the struggles that they had in the Anchorage hatchery were a little more unforeseen as well. So I think we thought we had a better plan when we put this together, if I remember correctly. I'm going back. I'm dusting off some memory. I see the senator here might help me with some of my memory on that.
Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, speaking of memories, if I recall correctly, some of the issue in Fairbanks was actually finding a suitable water source. And you talk about if you lose the one well that is maintaining the facility, you need to have that backup well. So I imagine that's going to be a rather expensive endeavor.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, yes, I don't have the exact amount on the top of my head, but I believe that that well was somewhere in the neighborhood of about $1 million, something around that. The existing water, you are correct. There's high iron content, so we have an elaborate filter system that's in place to filter the water before it hits the fish. Just they and it's cold. There is some heat exchangers that we have to heat the water for better growth of the fish. So far, the hatchery's been functioning very well. Both hatcheries have their production. We haven't had any issues with that. It's just that as they're aging, there's concerns that we may not be able to keep that up without maintaining those hatcheries and the systems that are in place.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Giesel?
So just a comment. It's not really a question. You know, we have quite a backlog of deferred maintenance on buildings and other facilities. If we defer maintenance on fisheries, we lose on fish hatcheries, we actually lose the facility and the fish. So it seems prudent to keep some kind of fund going.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cogg.
One last point. I brought it up, and I'll probably get bit for it, but we always want to try to keep our promises. And we have come into the place where we just are not able to keep the promise that we set out to do. That's the main thing, and I just wanted to bring that up, that this is going to be part of the maintenance and enhancement that almost everybody has now come to expect. But without this, we can't afford it. And it just needs to be said out loud. That's the mea culpa for some of us who thought we could do this without adding the surcharge into perpetuity.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. That's what public testimony is for, so we'll see how folks feel about that. I'm going to open public testimony on Senate Bill 189. Before we go to public testimony, however, I'm going to mention that I'm happier with the clarity in the fiscal note. I understand the importance of hatcheries and support them where appropriate. I served on the Cook Inlet Aquaculture Board for years, and they require maintenance for a lot of reasons. But I'm on the fiscal note on page 2 of 2, and we don't have lines on fiscal notes, but it clearly states that this funding is to provide ongoing maintenance at the department's sport fish hatchery facilities, which makes me more comfortable than the language in the bill. So I just wanted to clarify that. I don't think it's as clear on page 2, line 9 and 10, as it is in the fiscal note. I don't know if you have any comments about that, but if you do, I'd love to hear them.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, again, Tom Talby. From our perspective, sport fishing facilities, in our mind, would be the hatcheries. We don't own many other facilities. There's a few office buildings we have, but they're not. I mean, they might be our staff offices, but I guess I would think that sport fishing facilities would refer more to the hatcheries than other properties that the department may have.
Thank you. With that, that opens public testimony. Well, public testimony is open. Is there anyone in the room or on the phone willing to testify on Senate Bill 189? Seeing no one, there's no one online. Online, we still have, well, here we have Mr. Frenette, who's been now changed to questions. And we have Ms. Hanke, of course. So do we have any other questions? Yes, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of a detailed question. There's a really nifty, colorful chart on current price and estimates of revenue and the reduced prices and estimates of revenue for each license type. And there's one of them I don't quite get. I wonder if you could explain, for non-residents, a one-day sport fishing license. So if I'm reading this right, and happy to be wrong, the surcharge goes down 50%. But the revenue is supposed to go down 65%. The rest of them all look pretty proportional. What's our expectation with the non-resident one day?
Mr. Chair, Senator Keel, I may defer to our accounting staff that's here, Mr. Frenette, and he may be able to respond to the difference on that.
Mr. Frenette, if you can join us, we'll clarify the question. Once again, Senator Keel, excuse me.
Oh, sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the on the chart, non-resident one-day sport fishing licenses, the surcharge goes going down from $10 to $5, but the revenue estimate is going down from $1.2 million to $550,000. So that's about a 65% drop in revenue with a 50% drop in the fee. Are we expecting a change in behavior from fishermen, or what? What do we think? I'm just checking in on that one. It's one of the bigger numbers in there.
For the record, Brian Frenette, Assistant Director with Sport Fish Division. Through the Chair, Senator Keel. The revenue's really a function of the volume of the licenses being sold. So there's a significant number of one-day non-resident licenses being sold, particularly in Southeast Alaska, tied to the cruise ship industry. So that's what's accounting for that big difference in revenue drop, or not big revenue drop, to put it in proportions.
Senator Keel?
Mr. Chairman, I think we're expecting slightly increased numbers of cruise passengers, so maybe I can follow up afterwards and get a little clearer explanation, or maybe I can clarify the question if I'm asking it poorly.
So I believe the question that you can get back to us is you're dropping from $10 to $5 on the non-resident one-day sport fishing, yet you're obviously not using the same assumption for the number of one-day sport fishing licenses purchased, or else it would be half. So I don't want to put you on the spot. please get us that information. I think that would be helpful. Any other questions? Okay, we are going to hold this bill. Committee members, please. I have testimony, public testimony. Oh, Senator Giesley.
I was just about to ask you, is public testimony still open, or is it closed?
It's going to remain open until we meet again. And if you have any amendments for either of these bills, please try to get them to me by Monday. Pretty simple bills. I may be looking for a little bit of clarity, but if you can please answer the questions we have outstanding, and we'll pick them up again next week. So I appreciate you all being here. I thank you. With that, if there's any written testimony on these two bills, the committee email is sres@akleg.gov, and we will set both bills aside, as I already said. Having no further business before us today, I want to thank our LIO moderator, Nate Williams, and Chris Dickrell with Senate Records, and my staff, Conrad Jackson, for being here and your hard work today. With no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at, it's possible to see that clock, 4:20 p.m.